So remember, basically what we were doing is perturbing around the NFRW background, right? So we were doing perturbing the metric. So we were writing g mu nu as the background piece plus the other stuff. And this was our usual FRW. Which we assume is homogeneous, like that. And what we had done is basically looked at all the terms in G mu nu, in delta G mu nu, and we'd arrived at this scalar vector tensor decomposition. So we worked really hard to separate out the true scalars from the vectors from the tensors. And we found a whole bunch of terms. We found four pieces of the scalar, which I was calling phi, psi, b, and e, I think. We found a couple of vectors. These guys were something like si and fi. And we found a true tensor part, which was hij. Cool. Everybody showed up. OK, so remember, you know, these guys had special conditions on them, which reduced the degrees of freedom. So these each had 2. So this was 4, and this was 2. And we had 10 degrees of freedom. So we were pretty sure we had everything. And then what we did is say, OK, actually, remember, we have some redundancy because we can do coordinate transformations. So we looked at taking the coordinate x mu to x mu tilde, which was the original guy plus some infinitesimal shift. And to be consistent with the division that we did here, we actually had to write this guy, c mu, in the spatial part as a piece that was a derivative of a scalar, which I labeled zeta, and then what would have been the transverse part, which is left over, which again has a similar condition to these guys. Okay. So once we did that, we were able to take our generic expression for how the components of the metric transformed to give ourselves equations for how these scalar pieces transformed. Okay, and that was that sorted out for us that redundancy. So basically what we found, remember we worked out only one of these, but basically we just plugged in this expression to the generic transformation that we had for this guy and found, for example, phi tilde was the original phi minus, I think it was something like a c0 prime. Okay, and then similarly for all the other ones, they all turned into something that looked like themselves plus a correction due to these coordinate transformations. So one looked like that. V, remember this was sitting originally in what looked like the vector part of the off-diagonal term. This one has a zeta prime and a c, 0. Sorry, it's a minus. And E was just itself plus zeta. Okay. So the conclusion that we had at the very end was that we can remove 2 scalars with a choice of coordinates. Okay. So we can choose zeta equals minus e. And we can choose, c naught, so that it gets rid of these two guys. Okay. So what does that mean? Well, it means 2 things. Basically, it means that we've already found some of the redundancy here. So we removed 2 of the 10. It also means that we have a choice about how we make coordinates. And how we make that choice is going to simplify the problem or not, essentially. So there are one option. So basically, what we can see from this is that we can define gauge invariant combinations and these are things that don't change when we do a coordinate transformation. So those are more physical, right? Just as in any other gauge theory that you've worked with, if we look at the things that are independent of coordinate change and they're 0 or whatever in one set, then it's easy to change coordinates and say that quantity is still going to be 0 in the new set of coordinates. So they're nice physical combinations, and you can imagine there are going to be 2 of them because we have these 2 choices that we can make, and those are usually defined this way, capital phi. So remember, primes are always d by d eta's, capital psi. Okay. So these are useful combinations, because what you can do is you can work in one gauge where, for example, these expressions are very simple, something like this, and get a simple result, and then transform any coordinate system you want. Okay. So we didn't do it, but you can use the exact same procedure that we did for the scalars, or one of the scalars, right? I'm too lazy to go through all this algebra, but you can do the same procedure for the vectors, and you find that you can also remove one vector. Or similarly to these guys, you can define a combination of them, which is gauge invariant. And let me just call that V with a bar. Sometimes in some notations you see bars used for gauge invariant variables. I've used it for the background here. It's also gauge invariant sometimes. And this combination is Si minus something like that. Okay? And now we've removed the 4 degrees of freedom that we expected because by coordinate transformations. And so the tensor is actually, the tensor part is already gauge invariant. In practice, what this means is, like I said, you could try to always work with gauge invariant variables, and that would be really nice. In practice, what's often easier is actually to just choose a simple gauge. That's a good physical choice. So you can define these and work with them, basically, or choose a gauge. And of course, be careful, right? So a typical one that you've already seen before, and that's quite useful, so for example, is this Newtonian gauge, we'll call it conformal Newtonian. And you remember we were writing it before and we were only keeping phi and psi, basically. So we had set B in that gauge choice was E, was 0. And this is a nice choice for a couple reasons. One is that, I'm not sure if you saw it before, but this guy ends up being sort of the analog of the usual Newtonian potential. And so a lot of things, you can check your physical intuition about how things are behaving by checking the limit of a weak field for phi. The other thing that's nice is that you can see that any choice, so any transformation now, any choice for either zeta or C0, leads to B not equal to 0 or E not equal to 0, right? Because basically these guys both depend on things that don't have any derivative in them here and here. So this is a good choice in the sense that any coordinate transformation we do now is going to take us away from this gauge. So in some sense, we've used all of our freedom here. Okay. A lot of choices that's not true for, and you can easily imagine why, because there are a lot of derivatives appearing here, right? So you can imagine that if you make some other choice, let's just contrast briefly what's called synchronous gauge. And there we're going to set phi equals 0. And I think let's set b equals 0. Okay. You can see that I'm going to be able to make a coordinate transformation, right? Because basically, if you look at the definition of phi, I can add anything to this guy that doesn't change this derivative here, right? So you can still choose, so still allowed. Is to take the time coordinate goes to the original thing plus something that doesn't change as a function of eta. So we can make some function C1. So this is going in that C0 piece. So I think as long as we make it C1 of xi of the spatial part over A, then this doesn't change that piece in the derivative parentheses. Does that look right to you guys? So the A is going to cancel, yeah. And as long as this derivative of this is 0, we can still do that, right? So we still have actually this freedom. And to make sure that that goes through for B, we just have to compensate in what we do for zeta, what we did here. But again, zeta comes in with the derivative, so you can see a derivative of eta, you can see that we're going to be able to do it. And just make sure I get it right. So to compensate, you need to take xi, just xi tilde, where we just need to get rid of this. And since it appears without a derivative, basically it's going to be an integral of this thing. And this thing didn't depend on eta, so let's just pull it out. And you have, again, because zeta itself only comes in with a prime, you can again add any function that's just a function of the spatial parts. So you can add any c2i of xi. Okay? So in other words, we haven't used all of our freedom here. So there can be, in this gauge, there can be still be gauge modes. Sorry, I think I can just leave it as that, C2 of xi. It's probably fine, right? Yeah. I think you can probably add a different function to each of the different i's, so let me keep that there. Yeah. But this one is fixed. That's right. Thanks. Yeah? Yes, it's quite similar, actually. I think, isn't it? Yeah. In fact, I think it's probably exactly the same. Okay, so often in practice then what people do, and you can open probably any cosmology book, but Weinberg especially has one page where he just lists da-da-da-da-da. If you take any of these choices now, any of these gauge choices, you can write the Einstein equations for all of these terms here, okay? And what you see is something that I'm not going to show because it's really long, but you can check, is that all of these, the equations for each of these terms, the scalar, vector, and tensor, all decouple. So what's really nice about the work that we did that we went through here is that now we can independently write equations for scalar modes, vector modes, and tensor modes. And by modes, I mean that I'm considering the Fourier modes of each of those. So, sorry, is it right in your face? So the good thing is, let's say, we can evolve separately the scalar, vector, tensor components. What that means for inflation is that for tensor modes, we're essentially done, right? So for inflation, we have this scalar field inflaton, and we have a scalar fluctuation of that guy that we still have to worry about how to deal with combined with all of these. But that thing doesn't source a true tensor part of the equation. So for tensors, we're done. For tensors in inflation, of course. And so in the tutorial today, you can go through a few simple steps using a particularly simple gauge, and you can show that you already know the answer for the expression for the power spectrum for tensor modes. So we still have to worry about scalars. And to worry about the scalars, we have to go back to the original reason that we were doing this, which was the Einstein equation, right? So the whole reason we started this procedure is we said, if we have delta phi, we look at the Einstein equation, we're going to have to deal with the metric perturbations. And for the scalar field, that's still true. We haven't taken care of that yet. So let's go back and talk about the stress energy tensor. So basically, remember that the reason we started all this is because we had T mu nu is equal to length minus 2 t mu nu. And we were dividing up this guy. Dividing up this guy. Right? So this is our FRW. This now, we're done. We have a big long expression for what this is, right? For each of the components, you could work it out. This one, T bar mu nu, is our scalar field, and we know what the stress energy tensor for that guy looks like, right? So we had T 0, 0 was minus the energy density, and I just had the kinetic piece and the potential, V of phi. And we had Tij was diagonal, and it was the pressure. And that was the same thing, but with, minus here. That was the same thing, but with minus the potential energy. Okay. So the only piece of this equation that we still don't know is this one. So let me just say that for inflation, we're going to go back and we're going to do this a simpler way, which you can probably guess because the origin of this equation, right, just comes from the variation of the action, the full action, containing R and the scalar field. So what we're going to do on probably on Wednesday is simplify our lives by just for inflation working with the action itself from the very beginning, and that everything is quite straightforward. But part of the point of going through this exercise is that for things that aren't inflation, right, so when you start talking about cosmology where you have sources that are photons and dark matter and things like that, you don't usually start with the action. Instead, you have some expression for the energy density in photons by distribution over some momentum modes, things like that. So this procedure, and I think you're going to do more of this in the last 2 weeks, if you take the last 2 weeks, leads you to a set of useful expressions that you can use very generically. Okay, for inflation, it confuses things a little bit. Maybe it's slightly easier to just work directly with the origin of this equation. But for other sources, this is a procedure that's going to be useful. So I want to go through a few more steps in this direction, also because you can get some intuition already for what happens in inflation without going back to the more complicated formalism, if you like. Okay. All right, so what we're going to do is look at T mu nu for a sort of generic cosmological source. Okay. And for a generic cosmological source, we're going to look at, this is T mu nu. For fluid. And for inflation, it's going to be a perfect fluid, and that simplifies things also. Okay. So generically, we can write T mu nu as equal to the pressure times T mu nu. Some of those guys times the fluid velocity, mu nu. So these guys is the velocity, the four velocity. And what's nice is that we can define things in the rest frame of the fluid and set u0 is minus 1 and ui is equal to 0. So this is the rest frame. The fluid. And basically what it tells us, what it does is it removes off-diagonal pieces in T. Right? So if we think this in the local rest frame of the fluid, we want everything to be isotropic. And so we don't want any off-diagonal components that introduce a direction, essentially. So what we want is T0i equal to 0. And you can check that in this frame, that's exactly what you get. Okay. So more generally, you're going to have a normalization condition that you can write for a more generic velocity. And you want g mu nu, mu nu, equal minus 1. Okay. So what's nice about this is you can pretty much use it to model most sources. This is a perfect fluid. More generally, you are going to have off-diagonal terms. And so let's just reiterate that for a perfect fluid, you have the diagonal component to be exactly what we wrote down over here, that it's just the pressure. But more generally, that doesn't have to be true. And you can get pieces that don't just look like delta functions. And usually those are called sigma ij. Okay. This thing sometimes has the name anisotropic stress. Well, the anisotropic part is kind of obvious. It's just off-diagonal stuff. Okay, so we need all of that because we're going to go through the same procedure, essentially, that we did for the metric, right? If we want to be able to truly decouple the scalar vector tensor parts of this equation, we need to make sure that the source, this t mu nu, delta t mu nu, is similarly written as, you know, scalar vector and tensor terms. Right, then we really have the full set of equations that decouple. That's our goal. Okay. So you can basically see that when I start to look at perturbing components of this thing, they're going to be delta p's, delta rho's, delta g mu nu's, which we already know about, and delta u's. But the delta u's simplify a little bit because of this normalization condition. So we're going to have things like delta u 0 and delta u I. But this guy from the normalization condition is actually fixed in terms of the perturbation to the metric. And it says that delta u0 up or down is the same, and it's all equal to 1 half delta g00 plus or minus plus. Okay. So we're going to work out a couple of just a simple example. So again, you know, to really do this in generality takes a lot of algebra, but we're going to do just one of them, basically, so we can get an interesting equation for inflation. So I think I want to do, let me do t00. Okay. Okay. So basically I'm trying, you might have noticed, I'm trying to simplify my life by avoiding a lot of extra A's being carried around. Part of that is to work with one up and one down. And also, I'm still using, I guess I erased it, but I'm using the metric actually in cosmological time for the moment. Okay, so I'm going to go back to dots for most of this. Okay. Of course, I say that, and now I promptly switch to lower indices. Well, all right. Well, let me do it lower so I don't lose A's. Okay. Okay, so the full expression for T00, we can just look at what it is over there, right? So certainly it's P G00 rho plus p, and these are u0 squared, which is really simple on the background. So delta t00 is going to have a bunch of parts, right? So basically, I just want to keep the first order term. I want to take these all to be their background value plus a perturbation, and I just want to keep the part that is first order in any perturbation. Okay? So here I'm going to have two terms. So I'm going to have delta p with g00 background. I'm going to have p bar with delta g00. I'm going to have delta rho plus delta p. Background value of this thing is 1. And then I'm going to have rho bar, p bar. So this is really, this is going to be U0 bar plus delta U0 squared. So I'm going to have two terms that are identical, which are 2 times U0 bar, which is minus 1, and delta U0, which I said was 1/2 G0, 0. Okay, and G0, 0 bar. Nope. Delta. Okay, there we go. Okay, so let's see. Sorry, and this is multiplied by that, right? Good, there we go. Okay, so this is really minus 1 delta G0, 0 times P bar, so these terms are going to cancel. Let's see, we've got a, did I lose another? Nope, that's right. Okay, good. So what do I have? I've got delta P, and this guy is just minus 1 on the metric that I'm using. So which is also the reason that I don't pick up any factor when I do U0 upper and lower. Okay, so that's minus 1. I had a delta rho and a delta p. You can see that those guys just canceled. And I'm left with, this is overall a minus rho. Let's cancel, and a delta G0, 0, which I'll just leave as that. Okay? Does that look right? Should be a rho bar. Okay. Can you read that? So delta rho minus rho bar delta G0, 0. So you can similarly work out the rest of the components. So I'll just write them so you have them. That's a P bar delta G I0 minus rho bar plus P bar delta UI. So this guy isn't fixed. He's still free. Delta Tij, rho bar. Sorry, P bar, delta G, Ij, minus A squared, delta Ij, delta P. Okay. So basically, the only thing that's left to do to decompose this into the scalar vector and tensor parts, right here we have this new vector appearing. So you can guess we're going to have to do the usual thing. We want to write this as usual as a derivative of a scalar plus a real vector part. So we need, so remember our goal was still to get SVT. So we need to write delta UI as the derivative of some scalar. Let me just call it U. And then plus the transverse part like before. Okay? And here we don't have any genuine new scalar part appearing, because I started essentially with a perfect fluid, right? There was no scalar part, no tensor part when I started. But if I had had that more generic piece with that anisotropic stress, then I would have had to do the same type of decomposition of that perturbation as we did for the tensor part of the metric. Okay? So more generally for the tensor, we would have had delta Tij was this delta p part minus a squared delta ij delta p plus, So like before, this is the part that's just the scalar part here, right? So let's see. All right. No, I'm sorry. That's the wrong way around. I want to expand this guy. This is the scalar part of the perturbation. So more generally, I want the tensor part of the perturbation now also. Okay, so let's keep this term. This is the metric one. So this one could have been completely general, right? So I could have introduced pi dj of some scalar. I could have introduced the symmetrized version of derivatives of a vector part. And I could have introduced a real tensor here. So like before, this guy is traceless and transverse. This has the condition that tells me that I took out this piece, just like before. Okay. So that's it. That's the decomposition. So if you use a generic cosmological source in terms of a fluid, and you use this expression for the, these should all be deltas, sorry. And you use these expressions for what the perturbations look like, then you're allowed to write just the equations for example, the tensor part for the metric on one side of the Einstein equation, and the tensor part for T mu nu coming from here. Okay, so you can write equations for just those components, and you don't have to worry about the other components mixing in. Okay. So just so the next, so remember when we did this for the metric, we went through this procedure. We wrote all of the terms, and then we said, okay, look, we still have this coordinate invariance, right? There's coordinate transformations that we can do that tell us we have too many degrees of freedom. So I'm not gonna do this step because I think this is what you're gonna do in the next 2 weeks of this course if you take it. But analogously to the, so like as before, you can consider how T mu nu changes under coordinate transformation. Okay? And this thing is a tensor just like the metric was, so you're going to have exactly the same type of transformation rule. We already worked it out, so you can just work it out again here if you like. And then what you would like to do in principle is you can use this to define even better gauge invariant variables. And you can define a gauge invariant version of the equation that we have for the fluctuations. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, sorry. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
What do you mean by having the bars on the delta GIJs and then both these?
Probably that's just being wrong. Thanks. Let's see. That's right, yeah. So I'm always trying to define the Bohr quantity and the delta quantity. So it's redundant. So the bar actually just means the background part. So I'm trying to be redundant so things don't get confused. But yeah, thanks. Okay. So you can see that when you actually do this procedure, some gauge choices that you make now can involve choices for what lives on the T mu nu side of equations. So for example, you could try to, so now when you choose a gauge, so choosing a gauge, let me say choosing a gauge can involve the delta T mu nu part. So for example, you could try to enforce delta rho equals zero everywhere, something like that. So you want to try to in other words, choose a sort of a time slicing that's consistent with no density perturbation, for example. So try to choose surfaces of constant density. So this whole thing is very powerful when you want to do sort of the generic cosmological perturbation theory for sources that aren't just the inflaton. Okay. But we're not going to do that. We're going to go back. And we're going to look at a couple of equations in a simple gauge, and we're going to use the Newtonian gauge. So a couple, let me say, a little insight from Newtonian. So one of the important things that happens, and this happens in any gauge, but usually it's easiest to derive a Newtonian gauge, is that the two scalar pieces that we have left in the metric, so here we have phi and psi, not equal to zero. So this is the expression you see written a lot with the phi in the TT part and the psi in the XI part. What you find is that these guys actually aren't independent once you add a source, right? So once you look at these set of equations, you find that these aren't independent, and you get an expression that looks like that depends on this anisotropic stress term, just the scalar part. So the two derivatives acting on that scalar part of that anisotropic stress must be equal to the two derivatives acting on the difference of these two scalar potentials. So the important thing about this, and the thing that you often see used in cosmology all the time, is that in many cases, these guys are actually equal, phi equals psi. Okay, so you can see that this equation is consistent with that, and you can try to check what it means to add constants. Yeah?
Is it m Planck squared or minus 2?
Let's see. So this guy is dimensionless, and I have one low, yeah. Right? Wait, sorry. So dimensionless needs to be dimension 2. So actually pi is not dimensionless. Pi is in energy, is in pressure, right? Pressure has units of the potential. Let's see. No, it must be minus 2 though. Okay. Yeah, okay. So basically this tells us that in the absence of, so when phi s equals 0, we can set phi equals psi. And this is certainly the case during inflation. So during inflation now, what this has told us is that we actually only have one guy in the metric that we might have to worry about, okay? And possibly this delta phi for the scalar field. So from now on, for inflation, only psi will appear. Okay. Yeah.
Why is pi s 0 for inflation?
So basically, this was living in that anisotropic stress part of the equation, which was a scalar that was coming from these off-diagonal terms. So for a generic scalar field, yeah, actually it's important. So for a completely generic scalar field, I can have any configuration that I want, essentially. But for inflation, the spatial derivatives are very small because they get inflated away, essentially, and the kinetic term is small. So there's no preferred frame during inflation except on very, very, very small scales. So for the, essentially, you can consider any piece that looked like that to be washed out, and you're just left with things that are pure scalar. So even though this looks like a scalar because it's living in this, it's actually part of that anisotropic stress. Okay, all right. So let's do one other thing that we can learn here.
So the linear and constant terms that you could have don't matter.
Yeah, so basically you can just, what we really want are pieces here that are functions of space and time, right, generic functions of space and time. So anything that you add that's a constant, you can just reabsorb into the definition of the stationary part and rescale everything. Okay. I think I want, did I erase the equation I wanted? No, okay. Okay, all right, so we're gonna do one other thing, which is we're gonna write down actually the equation for the scalar field and the metric perturbation in this gauge. Okay, so this, so for the scalar field source, remember we had, now this is phi, now this is phi my scalar field, so no more phi metric, okay, phi is now always a scalar field. It was the background piece plus the perturbation that can depend on space and time. So we can work out an equation now relating to metric perturbation and the scalar perturbation. And there are lots of redundant ways that you can write this equation, of course, as usual. The fastest way to get to the usual Friedmann equation is actually from the conservation equation of the stress energy tensor. So the fastest way is to look at the equation that comes from T mu nu mu equal to zero. And this is actually T mu nu times mu. Bunch of connection terms, alpha nu, u t plus b. So nu is the only thing that's left. Okay, so this guy equals zero. So you can imagine that what you need to do to get the perturbed part is to go through each of these guys and figure out what the perturbed part is, right, from the metric perturbation, and what the perturbed part of this T mu alphas are for this guy up here. Okay, so we basically already worked out for the scalar field what some of these terms are, the deltas are. And you can, the fastest way to deal with these things is probably Mathematica, so get yourself a nice Mathematica notebook that evaluates all these things for you, so that you plug in the metric, you evaluate all the terms, and then you can write down the equation. What you get, so basically we're going to look at the nu equals zero component. You can check if you do this for the background, you're going to get the usual equation of motion again for the scalar field. And to simplify the way I write the expression, so I don't have to work all of this out, I'm going to define delta t mu nu hat to include only delta t mu nu terms. So right, if I really start looking at t mu nu upper and lower, now let me use upper and lower t mu nu. If I really start looking at these guys, there are pieces that contain the metric, right? So they're going to be delta metrics in there. But I'm going to separate out that part just for sort of ease of calculation on the board, and I'm going to define this guy as only having delta t mu nu parts, and I'm going to put the delta g parts off on the other side, okay? So what I get is an equation. So this equation becomes d by dt. So because I'm looking at the nu equals zero part, this is going to give me a d by dt. T hat 0, 0. And I'm also going to work in Fourier space, because now all my derivatives just become k's. So what I'm going to end up with is, again, a mode equation, right? Equation in Fourier space for the modes of the scalar field. And there's a delta t hat 0 I. And you're going to see it has a familiar form, as it should, because we said this is just the thing that gives us the equation of motion for the background scalar. So at essentially at this order, when we expanded fluctuations, the quadratic part for the fluctuation should look very much like the quadratic part for the scalar field, except the metric piece, right? Minus h delta ti. So the part that's new is a part that depends on psi, d psi, dt. So basically, you can go through, and at a minimum, if you want to check this at least a little bit, you can check that when you evaluate delta t mu nu without the hat, you can see that the one that appears is actually, the one that's non-zero is the t00, and in, for example, the ij components and things like that, the thing it usually, the metric perturbation usually falls out. Okay. Okay, so this is the equation. But you just have to believe me for the moment. for the perturbation. Okay, and it looks messy, but you can evaluate each of these things without too much difficulty. A lot of them you can guess, right? Because this is delta T00. We know that the background piece is the energy density. So this is going to look like at least delta rho, right? And this one is going to look something like delta P. And when we write those in terms of the scalar field, right, we know the expressions for the, oops, I erased it. We know the expressions for the background energy density and pressure of the scalar field, phi dot square is g of phi. So once you find that the variations of those, they're going to look like, you know, things that have delta phi's and delta phi dots. Yeah, we can, so basically, I don't want to take the time to work it out, but you can just plug, you're going to plug this guy into the expression for T00, which we still have, actually, with the scalar field. And you know that the pressure and the energy density are the kinetic minus, plus or minus the potential. So this guy just becomes minus the background, phi dot, delta phi dot, derivative with respect to phi delta phi, right? Variation of the potential. Delta Tij. So you don't have to copy all this down. We're just going to find an interesting fact by looking at the size of all these terms. And it turns out they all have the same size, more or less, so you don't have to worry about the details. So you can see now, if I compare terms here, so let's look at all the terms here. And during inflation, the relevant time scale is the Hubble time scale, one inflationary time. So basically, d by dt's are going to scale like h's for inflation. Okay. So you can see, for example, that this term looks like h times phi zero dot times delta phi dot. We've got a term that goes like k times this guy, which is going to be a k squared over a squared. Again, a delta phi zero dot. So to make these terms look the same, I can do this and divide by h. At horizon crossing, remember we said we have k equals ah. So this term is essentially h squared over h times this combination, which again is the same size as this, roughly. Again, it goes like h, phi zero dot, delta phi. Okay. This one again, okay, there's an h, again, times the same thing. It's exactly the same size as that term. This one, again, exactly the same size because this piece is essentially the same as that. So basically all the terms on the left-hand side of this equation scale in the same way. So left-hand side is proportional to this quantity. Okay? So what I want to check, so basically up to and around horizon crossing, right? That's the thing that we've used here to get the rough order of these terms. So now let's check for comparison the side of the size of the right-hand side. So to do this, you need a 0-0 equation. But that's one you've probably written out several times. Let me change back to a dot and A. So this one is proportional to T00 on this side. And here it just contains perturbations of the G00 component of the metric, so it just has size. Okay. And basically, you can see that Again, when k is of order ah, these terms have essentially the same size. So we can just compare, for example, psi goes like a squared over k squared and Planck squared delta t 0, 0. So this again, a squared over k squared at horizon crossing, I can write this as, let's see, so this is going to be a squared h squared over k squared. Let me just multiply and divide by an h squared. 1 over h squared and Planck squared delta t 0, 0. This thing we know, this is rho, right? And if we go all the way back here, basically we can see that comparing this term and this term, there's a factor of rho plus p on the background. So let me divide, multiply and divide over here by rho plus p. So this term is basically, this goes like a slow roll parameter. All right, the difference between these guys is a phi dot squared over a Planck squared. This is essentially slow roll. So as long as this term is less than 1, this is less than 1, and we can drop the psi perturbation compared to this guy. Let me say that over here. So as long as k is large compared to ah, and that means that we're well inside the horizon, right? Inside the horizon. We can drop the right-hand side. Which is that? So then literally, the equation for the fluctuation, delta phi, coming from this side, if this was 0, it's exactly the equation that we had for the field itself, back when we were looking at the field in the Sitter space. So that tells us that the procedure that we've been doing for the scalar field, once we move to quantizing the fluctuations, when we're inside the horizon, that procedure goes through, and the answer that we've got is essentially the answer that we can use the whole time, up to horizon crossing. Okay? So in some ways, we already did the whole problem. So our old answer still applies, where we had p delta phi going like h squared over 2k cubed for the power spectrum. Okay. You can check. You can plug into this equation if you feel like it and check that we get back the exact same equation. So basically, the only additional thing that I've done here is you have some terms that are going to go like slow roll parameters. Okay, so really, the equation that you get is the same equation that we got plus slow roll corrections. And in fact, you can see that there's going to be a V prime prime term, which is like the mass term. So even more, this is really the equation for the massive scalar field, if you like. When you have these v phis, right? So there's a d by dt of that guy, which when you do this is going to be v comma phi phi with a phi dot, and that's like the mass term. Okay. Yeah.
When rho plus p delta psi over t 0, you say that the whole square applied, but we got our whole down square by doing the quantization procedure.
Yeah. So right. Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is what I'm going to get is the same, thanks. So what I'm going to get is the same equation of motion for the field delta phi here that we got for the field phi before. Mm-hmm. And you're going to go through all the same steps. So basically, once you have this equation, you also need to quantize it in the background. The background is now sourced by the scalar field, but it's essentially, again, almost De Sitter, nearly De Sitter. So you go through the same procedure. But the answer is going to look exactly the same because the equation of motion that you started with was exactly the same. So it's, you just do the quantization of these fluctuations. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? I realize this was a lot of equations and maybe not much concept, but the two important concepts are the two things that we had here. First, there's only one, when I erase, there's one independent metric fluctuation. When we go through the procedure inside the horizon, we've basically already done the work that we needed to do. Okay, that's the basic upshot of all this. We saw that by going into a particular gauge, but we didn't have to choose that gauge. That was just an easy one, and we could have done everything in a gauge invariant way and things like that, but we were able to get those two physical concepts out of a particular gauge choice, which was relatively simple. Okay. So what we don't have yet, so this isn't the reason we're not done is that what we do not care about is exactly the scalar field inside the horizon, right? What we care about is what gets translated outside the horizon and comes back in today in the universe that we know after inflation. So the reason we're not quite finished is this isn't exactly the variable that we care about, delta phi. Oops. Well. So the remaining part of the problem, what happens? What's at the horizon, right? So basically, we know that the picture is inflation progresses, modes go out of the horizon, then they do something, right, out of there. And meanwhile, the background is changing. So inflation stops. You know, we go back into a radiation and matter-dominated universe, and eventually those modes are going to come back inside the horizon. But we need to know what happened to them in the intervening space, right? So that's the crux of the problem now. So basically, this is a problem because inflation ends afterwards. The evolution is completely different. It's radiation or matter-dominated. We need to know how to deal with that. So basically what's going to happen is the term that I dropped, I could only drop when things were inside the horizon. And that's not going to be true any once things leave. So just from the equation that we had here, which I erased, we can suggest, so the expression we had before, and we're going to be more careful about this next time, expression for delta t mu nu mu suggests we define a variable that's a combination of those two perturbations. Okay. So now this is going to be the zeta that appears for the rest of your life in cosmology. So it's not the zeta that we had when we were talking about this metric perturbation. This is the big zeta, this zeta. And we want that to be a combination of the metric part and the scalar part. And a particular combination is designed to scale out a lot of those terms that were appearing in the equation. Okay. So basically, this just comes from, part of it comes from comparing the terms that appeared in these two sides. And this has the nice feature that inside the horizon. So again, the same limit that we used to evaluate that guy over there. We can drop this. We can evaluate this with the term we had on the board before. And what you find is that zeta is very simply related to delta phi. Okay, so what I've done here is I've dropped psi, and I've used delta t hat 0i, which we had on the board before, was equal to a to the minus 2 zero dot, and I've used that again, rho plus p, which is just phi dot squared on the background. Okay. So this variable is going to be really nice because it's going to allow us to go into the regime where this thing becomes important. But in the regime where we already evaluated everything, it goes back to something that's just related by a constant, something that's nearly a constant to what we already calculated. So inside the horizon, calculating the spectrum for zeta compared to phi is relatively simple because you just need to do this transformation on that guy. Okay. So we're going to see next time that this variable is fantastic, actually, because it's conserved outside the horizon. So that means that once we work in the right variable, things leave the horizon, the amplitude of fluctuations is frozen, and we don't have to worry about anything that happens until it re-enters the horizon. Up to, of course, in some simple situations. Right? Oh, there's always complications. But for simple situations that we care about, it's going to be very simple to evolve this guy back into where it re-enters the horizon. And that's the other thing that's nice. So that's what we'll do next time.